Piano Jazz is made possible by the National Endowment for the Arts, the Friends of Piano Jazz, and NPR.
Hello, and welcome to Piano Jazz. This is your guest host, Elvis Costello, appearing at the kind invitation of your regular host, Marion McParland. The last time I appeared on this program, Marion and I performed a version of her composition, Threnody, for which I'd written words. So perhaps it's appropriate that the guest on today's show is also a songwriter, but so much more. He is one of New Orleans' most gifted musicians. His reputation as an arranger, record producer, and the writer of such tunes as Ruler of My Heart, Ride Your Pony, Working in a Coal Mine, Freedom for the Stallion, and Southern Nights stretches from the early 60s to the present day. His musical personality begins with a unique relationship with the piano keyboard. He is a living embodiment of the rich musical heritage of the Crescent City. He is, of course, Mr. Alan Toussaint. Alan, thank you for joining me on Piano Jazz.
My pleasure.
Well, you just led straight into the thought that I had, that the piano was a fixture in my grandfather's front room, and it was a fixture in many people's parlor, whether or not they could play it. I wondered, when was the first time you heard the actual sound of the piano, and what were the circumstances, and how did it strike you?
Well, a piano was given to my sister by my aunt. And though my family was the poorest Job's turkey, you might say, the ladies thought it would be quite dignified for a young lady like my sister to play the piano or violin. And there was a piano at my aunt's house that wasn't being used, so she gave it to my sister. So the men went out and got it on a truck, and I was on her about 6 and a half. And the street was very bumpy, and they had it on the back of a truck and bringing this old upright down. And every time we hit a bump, the strings would resonate, and I could hear down the street, and all the kids were running behind and seeing this big piece of furniture coming. And they set it in the front room of my parents' home, and I walked over to it and just touched one note. And it was instant gratification. It wasn't like picking up a trumpet for the first time and getting almost nothing, a small elephant sound. But I got a pleasant sound by just touching this large instrument. So it was love at first touch. Now, I had heard some recordings, but I hadn't paid attention to what was what yet. But when I pressed that first note on the piano, I wanted more immediately.
Did anybody else in your family of the older generation play the piano? Was anybody able to go up and get a tune out of it right away?
Yes, there were. Since it came to the house then, I discovered that I had uncles like Uncle Emmanuel, who played beautiful staggerly and How Long Blues only when he was drunk. Yeah. I'm not sure if he could play when he was sober. I didn't see him play sober. He never would bother.
People did play music more in that generation. I think it's sort of gone away. That's the point I was making, a lot of people, even people in modest circumstances, had a piano, and as you say, people could play something on it. That the thing that you mentioned at the beginning was that it was thought that your sister, it was an uplifting thing for your sister to learn to play the piano. So that presumably means piano lessons were involved.
Yes, and that did not work out well for her at all. They got her a teacher right away, but he was the kind that would spank your hand.
Yeah.
And when he first did that, that just shocked her and turned her off.
Yeah. And how about you? Did you go to piano lessons?
It was years later, when I was about 8 and a half, that my mother decided to try me in Xavier Junior School of Music. I took about 8 lessons before she gave up, because she had understood that the boogie woogies had me.
Did you hear any classics at that time from your music teacher, or did you in 8 lessons only never really get past simple exercises?
Well, not in rigid studies. My mother had a very highbrow taste. She loved classical music, so I heard it a lot. Like on Sundays, I heard operas in the evenings on the small radio. And my mother just really liked that kind of music, so that sort of just seeped into my life. But I just was too impatient to really practice the classics, so I would try and learn them just like I learned other recordings off of the radio, and of course you wind up with something.
Did you ever sit down and try and pick out a theme that you heard?
Oh, yes.
Is there any way that you could show how you is there any tune that comes to mind now that you would think of?
Well, I can say that I learned Grieg's Piano Concerto. My mother bought an Emerson record player, and during that day, if you bought a record player, they gave you Lanyap. They gave her two albums, and one of them was a classical album, and one of them was a good music album with Benny Goodman and the likes. But the classical album had on it Paul Weston's orchestra playing Grieg's Piano Concerto. And it was beautiful, but the piano was an old upright, so it was a half step off. So you always play it up, but I didn't know that yet. When I learned things off the radio, I learned what they were in, and if they were in B, I figured that's what the key they recorded it. So Grieg's Piano Concerto, I pretty much learned it all in B flat minor. And it wasn't until I was, upper teenager before I found out it was Grieg's Piano Concerto in A minor, which made a whole lot of difference.
If you sat down to play a theme from that now, which key would you go to?
Oh, I would go to A minor. Yes, yes, I would definitely. Yeah, I wouldn't go to A flat now.
But it seems to me that there are the beginnings of your sense of melody. It's something that all jazz musicians do in their apprenticeship, is to transcribe things. And although you may not have been writing these down, you were absorbing them by ear, very complex music, and playing it in another key. That's quite an extraordinary apprenticeship. It must have had some impact. Maybe it's not something that you were self-conscious about. The other element of the New Orleans musical tradition in which I think of you is the unique rhythmic brew that's in New Orleans music. There are perhaps two or three or four or five different threads, different churches, if you want to think of them, in New Orleans music. I mean, there is New Orleans jazz, which is world famous, and perhaps the music that's come out of rhythm and blues, but is rhythmically motivated in a way that's unlike any other city in America or anywhere else in the world. And it probably has to do with the fact that New Orleans is, in some ways, part of the Caribbean.
Yes, so I didn't know how different it was from the rest of the world, but I knew what this music was, and it did have its own thing. And, of course, a big element was when I was shocked by Professor Longhair.
Yeah. What was the first piece you heard by Professor Longhair? And tell me just about your impression of him.
Oh, the early pieces were things like the Hattie Bounce, and things even like In the Night. And the one that I was sold forever was when I first heard Tipitina, of course. Again, that syncopation, that has been a most important element. But when I heard Professor Longhead do things like Hey Little Girl.
Yeah. Could you play a little bit to give us a signature of his playing?
Yeah, well, he played things like, simple as that is, for a kid when I was a little boy to hear that was very interesting. And when he got to the five chord and played a minor on it,
yeah, there's a moment there where it makes you sit upright. Yeah,
yes.
And the ornamentation in the right hand is something that very characteristic. There's something in all New Orleans piano playing, and before him there's Toots Washington, isn't there? Tell me about your impression of him.
Well, Toots Washington was from the Jitney days, and Jitney was a word used for the concept of what was going on. There would be one band at one end of the dance hall and another band at the other end of the dance hall. And the proprietors insist that when this band was about to go on break, when they played their last downbeat, that other band had to start immediately because they didn't want any silence to lose the crowd at all. Toots Washington was back in that day, and also it was a day when if you played a string instrument, you played piano, guitar, bass, violin, everything with a string on it. But even though many of the things he played was fairly simple, they had a profound finalness about them. Also, sometimes he sounded a bit like Art Tatum. He was an amazing guy, but he did play the junk of blues.
Tell me what this is. I've heard you use this expression, that there's terminology for styles that is subdivisions of these New Orleans piano styles that are almost like a separate line to the continuum of jazz piano, jazz composition, but yeah. I don't even, other than that word, it's a blues form. Can you illustrate it for me?
Well, which one?
Junker.
Oh, the Junker blues. Domino played something like that on the Fat Man,
yeah.
Which was the same kind of thing.
And you can hear these songs like Stagger Lee, which goes back a really long way. As a song, it goes back a huge amount. And these rhythms start to take these tales that are told over and over again. And each song singer, each piano player adds a little bit to it, adds their little. It builds up as a tradition, I suppose.
Oh, yes. It goes on and on. And it grows. Even the thing we mentioned about Professor Longhair and this Halo girl. Later on, it developed into. That was the natural evolution.
Yeah. And once that movement comes into it, you start to really hear what I think a lot of people hear as that particular Church of New Orleans piano playing, that movement there that you just shifted to, and you hear that more developed into patina. So tell me, do you feel that the pieces such as Tipitina, you've played it, other New Orleans piano players have taken that up as being a central song. It never seems to get old.
Right. It's as profound as Bach.
Can you play it in this moment? Can you find it in any moment that you sit down? Is it? I've heard you play it many times.
Tipitina?
Yeah. A lot of songs have that ability in New Orleans music to be played for a long time. I mean, do you think that comes out of that dancehall tradition?
Oh, yes.
And building a tension up. It's not about getting wildly out in harmonically so much as this constant growing, rolling form.
Yes. Good.
And Professor Longhair was a great singer.
Yes.
When did you find your voice? I think sometimes you're a little modest about your own singing, but you started to hear the voice in relation to the piano as a songwriter. What age were you when you first thought of doing that?
Well, I started writing songs with lyrics to them at 12. But as far as my own voice, I've never paid much attention to that because that's the last thing on the totem pole. But writing songs seem to have been a natural evolution. Yeah. But I preferred thinking them than to actually sing them. But then I began writing for other the singers to sing. Of course, I had to sing it so they can get to know it. And I'm still singing about like that.
But how did you make that jump to actually showing them to people who presumably you felt could sing them publicly?
Early on, I became a session player in the studio to play on recordings. And sometimes those talent scouts or whoever were in charge would have a song for an artist and they may not have another one. And all sessions were done four songs during that day. A session was 3 hours and you always did four songs. And sometimes after I would be there and they played on one of the songs and it all went well, whoever was in charge would come over and say, "We need another song. Do you have any songs?" Even though I didn't have any at the time, we'd take a break and I'd write one. And during that break, and then I would sing it to the artists, and they would we'd record that. So,
and these songs are more, you know, the music that you're mentioning, listening, you've mentioned classical music, that opera and your mother's taste. And you mentioned Benny Goodman. You mentioned songs which are, you know, that I suppose they're either based on standards or they're jazz compositions. But the recording sessions you're talking about now are presumably more in the R&B pop realm.
Yes, yes. And let me do add that another important element I found in my early days of playing the piano, even early as the Professor Longhair, I heard a lot of hillbilly music on the radio before R&B got its rightful place on the airwaves. There was loads and loads of hillbilly music, so there was a lot of saloon-type pianos. Yeah. And I heard that
Moon Mulligan
trilling on the pianos, and I just thought that was a whole lot of beautiful things happening. So I went behind that with a vengeance.
It's the hidden soul music of America, yes, because people, again, because often the harmony is very simple. It explains a lot about where you led to jump forward quite a bit. It must have been perhaps not such a strange thing and probably quite a thrilling thing for you that an artist like Glen Campbell would pick up your song Southern Nights, which is a descriptive song. When you play it, it's totally of your life. When he sings it, I think of him as a very elegant country artist.
Yes, yes.
But he takes a song and it became reborn as a up-tempo country pop song. It was sort of a paid off something, really, that you were listening to all those years before.
I'm so glad he did, too, because he made it the people's song. At first, it was just mine.
Yeah.
It was just a story, because I didn't write it to be a song. But and it was just a culmination of life when my father would take us visiting out in the country to visit the old Creole-speaking people and everything that happened in the country, the smells, the sights, and things that the city never would see. I was just sharing that with a kind of music. And I sang through a Leslie to put it in the trees and in the breeze so I wouldn't take the responsibility singing a song.
Can I ask you just to sing a few bars of the melody, just to hear the melody expressed in that freer way that you play it for yourself in your own rendition?
Southern night. Have you ever felt a southern night? Free as a breeze, not to mention the trees, whistling tunes that you know and love so. Southern skies, just as could even when closed your eyes. I apologize. Anyone who can truly say that he has found a better way. Feels so good, it's frightening, wished I could.
stop this world from fighting. La da da, la da 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 da, la da 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 da, la da 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 da.
That's beautiful, Alan. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there's much more music in a minute with Alan Toussaint. Our program is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. I'm Elvis Costello, and this is Piano Jazz with Marion McPartland and friends. One of the things that isn't remarked upon in when people talk about New Orleans music, because they talk about good times and blues, and they talk about celebration and dancing and Mardi Gras, there's one strain of it that I hear in some of your choices, and I wonder whether you recognize this, is that New Orleans is more than most other southern cities, is a Catholic city. And I wonder whether there are some different hymns that one hears growing up in New Orleans. Then it seems to inform some of the ballad harmony. I mean, not to say that there isn't great harmony in Baptist hymns, you know, and probably a lot of the hymns are shared, but was there any church music that you heard in particular growing up that you feel crept into some of your choices?
Well, not by names, because they were very complex. I came up very Catholic, and I mean the altar boy and all of that, and loved it dearly. But I must say, when I'd leave Mass, if I could pass and sit on the church steps of the Baptist churches and sanctified churches, I did. So I always heard all of that and loved it dearly. But I must say that while Mass was going on, it was always the pipe organ and very rich in Bach sounds. And not that they were all Bach, but that's the first name coming to mind. But I couldn't say that I can hold on to any of those particular melodies, whereas in the Baptist church, I can say that there's some of those licks that I heard, they'll come out in a song of mine now, and I know that's where it came from.
And which titles in particular? Are there hymns that did you always think of?
Well, for one thing, Mother-in-Law, yeah. Even though that was a long time ago.
Mother-in-Law is one of your first big hit records that Ernie Cadeau had a huge hit on. And, now, tell us the connection to the Baptist hymn.
Well, there was a group called the Harmonizing Four, and a guy named Rick and then one named James. So they sung that, Father alone, shall not be moved, shall not be moved, Mother-in-Law.
Well, I never heard the song Mother-in-Law in that way, but could you give us a few bars of the way people would know it as a rock and roll record?
Yes.
Mother-in-Law, Mother-in-Law, the worst person I know. Mother-in-Law, Mother-in-Law, she worries me so. Mother-in-Law, Mother-in-law, every time I open my mouth, she steps in and tries to put me out. How could she stoop so low? Mother-in-law, 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 I come home with my pay. Mother-in-law, mother-in-law, she asks me what I've made. Mother-in-law, mother-in-law, she thinks her advice is the Constitution, but if she would leave, that would be the solution. And don't come back no more. Mother-in-law, mother-in-law, mother-in-law.
That line, yeah, just hangs with me forever. I've written it as a horn part,
yeah,
even when it had nothing to do with anything else, because it just seemed like, here it is.
It's the blues amen.
Okay, that's a wonderful way to put it.
It's true to say that some of the biggest names of New Orleans jazz made their name outside of the city. They had to travel. Louis Armstrong, General Morton, Sidney Bechet, they may have had their beginnings, and obviously so much of their music is informed by the culture of New Orleans, but they went abroad to become world acclaimed and to shape modern music, really, in the case of some of these people. There is another thread of New Orleans musician, of which you were one. Dave Bartholomew was another, that stayed in the city as record producers, songwriters, making records to send out to the world. I mean, they had a huge influence. Hundreds, and if not thousands, of songs that you've written, many of which have been big hit records for numerous recording artists, Irma Thomas, Lee Dorsey, but then the international artists like the Rolling Stones and The Who and Glen Campbell. And, you know, was that a very unusual experience for you once you reached a degree of fame to hear your songs around the world while you remained in New Orleans doing your job as an arranger, songwriter, record producer?
Yes, it was great. Great to hear about that, because I heard about it more than I actually heard it. During those days when those songs were playing in England and France and other places, I never did hear that. I just heard about it.
Yeah.
Because I was living one way, and every day I was going to the next thing. So I wasn't tuned into what the whole world was playing.
I think the song of yours, which has been covered by the widest range of people, might be Fortune Teller. The Rolling Stones, The Who, and we've even sung it together. Could we maybe sing a couple of bars of this together?
That'd be great.
Went to the fortune teller to have my fortune read. I didn't know what to tell her. Had a dizzy feeling in my head. Well, then she looked at my palm and said, "Honey, you seem kind of warm." I looked into a crystal ball. She said, "You're in love."
There's much more to come with Alan Toussaint. You can find artist information, set lists, and more on our website, pianojazz.npr.org. I'm Elvis Costello, and this is Piano Jazz with Marion McPartland and friends. It definitely used to be, if you wanted to hear Alan Toussaint play, or you wanted to work with Alan Toussaint in the studio, one had to travel to New Orleans. You and I first worked together in the early 80s, and you were kind enough to produce a record, and it was an extraordinary experience to come to this studio, C-Saint, that my band and I all associated with all these terrific hit records that you had produced. Paul McCartney came with Wings, you arranged La Belle's Lady Marmalade, and that was your role as you saw it as a songwriter. You only occasionally recorded as a vocal artist. You made a handful of records for Warner Brothers in the early 70s. What moved you towards finding a voice? Was it something that you weren't hearing in the interpretations of your songs?
Oh, no. I like the interpretations of my songs by others, even covers that I didn't do. One time, my partner, Marshall Seahorn, was trying to turn a deal with Scepter Records. Well, not only trying, but getting it done. And Steve Tyrell, who was an executive there, had been hearing me sing backup on Ernie Cato sometime, and especially Lee Dawson. And he thought my voice was something that could be up front. And he said, "Yes, we'll take the group, the meters or whatever, but we'd like Alan to do a recording." Mm. And I said, "Yes." And that was the first time I recorded an album where I actually sang as the artist. So that kind of started that. And it was just by request. And any time I've ever recorded an album on my own, vocalizing, it was a request from a company at the time.
But I was always wondering who that person with that great deadpan delivery, because Lee Dorsey had such an animated voice, and you would answer him on these records. I didn't know it was you until later on I read that it was you doing those voices. I didn't know who this other voice was, but it was like a conversation at times. And it also tips into the way in which you arrange for horns, which became very, very recognizable. I think that people in the rock and roll world, outside of the record successes you had as for singles artists, really became aware of it when you worked with the band in 1970. You arranged a live album for those. It lit up this repertoire, which was all very, very rich. And it was a curious thing because you mentioned growing up hearing all these music, hymns, hillbilly music, obviously jazz and rhythm and blues. And the band of perhaps all American rock and roll bands perhaps have access to more of that language than any other group at their peak. Their peak was at exactly the time that you worked with them. When you heard those songs and you were asked to do those arrangements, were you surprised by the references that you found in it? A lot of rock and roll groups didn't refer to as many things. You didn't find mandolins and instruments that were, you know, really from hillbilly music in rock and roll bands of that era. They were mostly first-time guitars. Did you hear nuances in that allowed you to write a different kind of horn chart? Because you spoke earlier on about writing for trombone and trumpet. You, at some stage, became very notable as a horn arranger.
Oh, yes. The band, they knew who they were without horns and all.
Yeah.
The first time I actually worked with them was on a recording called Life is a Carnival.
Yeah.
Did a single record with them. And there may have been another side, but Life as a Carnival was the one that I went to do. And an interesting thing, the way the drums was playing, the way it started off, I didn't know where the one was in the when it first started. And I wanted to start writing before I learned where the one was, because I liked that somewhere in the middle feeling. Because sometime when you turn a radio on or something and you hear something going, it's really nice if you don't get so familiar till you know where everything is. And when I first heard Life as a Carnival, I didn't know where the one was. And I started writing immediately because I knew I would get to know her name soon. So I wanted to kiss before I knew the name. But I was highly impressed with that, even that one recording of Life as a Carnival. So by the time they called me, which was much later, to do Rock of Ages, well, I knew a little bit about what I was getting into, but I was so elated at how fine-tuned they were about different sounds. Like Garth, an organ wasn't just an organ. He'd have a certain little tweening that he would do to it that makes it very special. Mm. And they thought euphoniums and things like that.
Well, these are sounds that are found in the environment of New Orleans, as you mentioned. And one of the things you mentioned about Life as a Carnival is the sense of hearing music from a little distance away, where you sometimes, as you're approaching music that's playing in the environment around a corner, you can't tell where one is.
Yes.
I personally love that sound when you enter a dance hall and you hear the band inside and you just hear the rumble of it, and sometimes it's a different song that's playing, and when you open the door you hear what's really, and it's actually more mundane when it's
yes.
being played.
Yes.
That's something that you've captured a lot in your horn arrangement, the surprise. And it does return to the keyboard, because when you illustrate the piano players that have obviously been so influential upon you, and I watched recently the film that was made of you sitting in a line flanked by Toots Washington and Professor Longhair, where you are talking about the, I mean, it's a very unusual piece of film to see. I suppose you would almost say three generations of piano player talking about the same fabric of music, but how to put these elements in the correct place in relation to the three styles of the piano players with respect to one another. I mean, was that an experience that was unique, or did you find time to play alongside these people that you admired on more occasions than that one?
Oh, no, that was it.
That was it. That's the
yes.
only time.
I would go and see Toots wherever he was performing in town, because I just loved his whole feeling about the music. And I didn't see Professor Longhair as much, but as I saw Toots. But every chance I got to later on, I went to see Fess as well.
Mm.
So it was always a pleasure to check them out.
Are there any other piano players that whose names are not so well known that you heard or heard about that were known in the city, whose reputation hasn't extended out or has been lost, or any that you can think of?
Well, I think a very exciting pianist in the city is DeVell Crawford, for one thing.
Yeah.
Henry Butler, I haven't heard that much piano playing going around in the last 20 or 30 years. The only way you know it's Henry Butler is it's more than everybody else is playing. That's probably Henry Butler.
Hmm. How about James Booker?
Of course. Save the best for last. James Booker, in my time, that was the ultimate far as I'm concerned. I met him when he was 12, I was 13. I was 1 year older than Booker. And at that time, he had a broken arm, but he had a cast on his arm. There was three of his fingers sticking out in his thumb. And he was sitting down in a radio station, which was WYLD, WMRY at that time. And he was playing like Bach's three-part inventions, but not just playing all the right notes, with all of the bravado that it meant.
Is there any way that you could illustrate a little bit of how he would approach anything of his repertoire?
No way.
There's no way you would.
I thought about it before we got started. And I thought if I was going to do Booker, and he wrote a couple of pieces like Blues Minuet, what I was hoping to be able to present to you, and it said, "Leave me alone." But
the music said, "Leave me alone."
Yes.
It spoke to you.
Yes. Not today.
Yeah, I've heard you play interludes where you will break out of a blues, break out of a rhythmic song into almost a classical phrase. And one that comes to mind right at the moment, it brings to mind a specific performance, which we can't share with the world because it was a radio performance in Germany that you did recently. You were in Germany for a song festival with our friend, the record producer, Joe Henry, and you played a version of Ellington's Solitude with Joe's 17-year-old son, Livon Henry. And I heard this performance, and it was one of the most beautiful things I had heard in many a year, because this is a song everybody knows so well. And what was so thrilling about it was hearing the exchange between someone like yourself, who has such a knowledge of the history of music, the tradition that you come from, playing with a young man who had the fire of the first discovery, command of his instrument, that the fire of everything is possible. And you realize in order to do that, there has to be a profound composition on which to have that exchange. And this is Solitude. Could I ask you to maybe play a little of that for us?
Indeed. Thank you.
That's beautiful, Alan. Thank you.
Thank you.
Solitude features on a record that you've made recently, which is called Bright Mississippi. It's yes. it in the main, it's songs which lie firmly in the New Orleans tradition. But how do you feel about these songs, such as Solitude, standards that have been so much the foundation of so much invention in jazz? Are there songs that your heart always goes to, your mind always goes to?
Well, I must say, what the album was speaking of, and I still love to call them albums that just feel right, feel good. Joe Henry brought something out that I hadn't paid attention to at all. I knew that certain things existed, but like I say, I've been busy doing something else. I never thought I would get around to doing what we did on this album, Bright Mississippi. I'm so glad he did, though. Joe Henry was the brains of the entire process, and in choosing all of the wonderful songs that which lend themselves to this moment, and it tied it in very well, and it put me into that world that I didn't think I deserved to be, really.
Well, I can't agree with you, of course. I mean, the record has you in the company of a younger generation of great jazz soloists, Nicholas Payton from the city, from New Orleans, Joshua Redman, the bass clarinetist, Don Byron, and my friend, the guitarist, Mark Rebo. And you do a version of Solitude with Mark Rebo, which is another kind of dialogue between guitar and piano. And I then hear you with this a young man playing, and the songs seem to have so many possibilities. I understand entirely that it must be quite daunting, I think, for any musician to go to songs like West End Blues. And that's a pretty tall order for anybody to cut West End Blues again, except in faithful tribute to Louis Armstrong, to try to imitate him. And it isn't what has been done in this case. It's looking at these songs as music alive today, and I think the beauty of this record that you've made with in the company of these musicians and with the guidance of Joe Henry towards this repertoire is to hear you playing many tunes that are thought of as a central New Orleans tunes, St. James Infirmary, but with a freshness of discovery, and to hear you in duet with Brad Mehldau. What was that experience like?
Wonderful. Because for one thing, these musicians who he put together, they were all so accomplished, and they were in the life that they lived. And of course, I don't want to write myself out of it, but it's a different thing in the life that they live and generally the life that I live, writing the next song and getting a good sound and good track down. So that's why it was such a pleasant surprise for me every step of the way. It still is. And these musicians, they were so inspiring. So the way I sound here had a lot to do with who was there.
But I hear you throughout the record feeding them the way I the thing that I responded to I found moving about your dialogue with a young musician in this rendition I keep returning to of Solitude is that it is about listening and it is about proposing something which is answered. There is sometimes a tendency among musicians to play for themselves, and what I hear in this, and maybe doing it with this music, which is in some senses familiar territory, the actual themes of the pieces,
yes,
to hear it played again with a freshness, and to hear you in dialogue with Brad Mehldau, or to hear you interacting with Nicholas Payton is moving to me. And there's a connection with this particular program, Piano Jazz, which is somewhat unusual, is that, of course, the esteemed host of this show, Mary McParland, was married to the great Jimmy McParland.
Yes.
Who, and this is a big step backwards in time, was the replacement to Bix Beiderbecke in the Wolverines. And one of the tunes of which they're both associated with is one that you perform on Bright Mississippi, Singing the Blues. So could I ask you to maybe play a few bars of that?
Yes. Thank you.
beautiful, Alan. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I'm having a rare old time here with my friend Alan Toussaint, and there's more to come in just a minute. Our program is made possible in part by the Friends of Piano Jazz and is a production of South Carolina ETV and Radio. I'm Elvis Costello. This is Piano Jazz with Marion McPartland and friends. I just wanted to return for a moment to these last few years, the events that followed Katrina, and the one thing that impressed me the most of all in your reaction to these catastrophic events and your own personal losses of your home and archive was stoicism and the sense of embracing a new opportunity in life. You have embraced this opportunity to go and become a performing musician again. How was that transition?
It's been extremely rewarding. I think it's one of the finest blessings of Katrina. There's many blessings that came with Katrina, much more than curse. And one was the results of the booking agent, Katrina.
It sent New Orleans musicians out to the world.
More New Orleans musicians got to work right after Katrina than ever before in history. But I must say, for me, it certainly transformed life and my thoughts about many things. The connection that it especially bring me together with you, Elvis.
Well, it's very humbling to hear you say that. But to sit with you and write songs together is one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life. We came together to try and put together a repertoire of these songs for a record we made called The River in Reverse. And we went into the studio, and truthfully, when we planned the recording of this record, New Orleans was still under curfew, and we had to begin it in Hollywood. And no sooner had we booked the studio that we found that there was a studio opening up. I think the night that we arrived in New Orleans, I remember we crossed the lobby of the Windsor Court Hotel and encountered a gentleman. I don't know whether he knew you or just simply recognized you. There was an older gentleman, and his demeanor was, "It's going to be okay now."
Yeah.
And I think that recording that music, the sentiment of going to record music in the face of those circumstances and seeing young men who have probably just come back from a tour of Iraq on the streets of an American city is something that will stay with me my whole life. Since that time, I've heard the spirit of a city that cannot be extinguished. And I really believe that. And I know you believe that. I think the thing that you've taught me the most of all is the lightness of touch that one has to have to say sometimes things that when you're inside, you're full of anger or emotion.
Absolutely.
And when we came to write a song for the River in Reverse album, you were doing an arrangement of Tipitina in a minor key, which I really loved. And I said, I wonder, would it be too much to presume to write a text, maybe telling something of the moment? And then we put together this piece, Ascension Day. But before that, I just have to ask you to play a little reprise, because you sing a song about Professor Longhair and some of those people that have moved you to the piano. Could you sing a little bit, play a little bit more of that style of piano playing, which has been right through all of this?
Absolutely.
This very special man, and thank you for letting me be around to see one as great as he.
Thank you, Lord. 'Twas in your plan, I trust. He was sent here for few of us. So now that he's gone his way, what can I say? But thank you, Lord. Not a soul was stirring, not a bird was singing, at least not within my hearing. I was 5 minutes past caring, standing in the road just staring. Thought I heard somebody pleading, thought I heard someone apologize. Some fell down weeping, others shook their fists up at the sky, and those who left seemed to be wearing disguises. Now there's a queen in waiting, not enough loving, too much hating, for the prince hidden within a man always seems to be hesitating. Hasn't been gone long enough for me to miss her, except for every minute of every hour, every day when I wish I could possess her. For the days pass by, for the alibis, so carry on that way. And in time, you pay, but we'll all be together come Ascension Day. Hanging on the tree like when it started, but I know that we'll return. Let me back the mule away, come Ascension Day.
Well, Alan, I have to thank you for this wonderful time that we spent together.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Marion McPartland's Piano Jazz with guest host Elvis Costello and guest Alan Toussaint. Piano Jazz is recorded at Manhattan Beach Studios in New York City and is a production of South Carolina ETV and Radio. The producer is Sherry Hutchinson, recording engineer Duke Marcos, assistant recording engineer Tyler Hartman, mastering engineer David Mitchell, engineering intern Dale Anderson, production coordinator David Lyon. The executive producer is Elaine Freeman. Special thanks to Clavier House New York, providers of the pianos heard on Piano Jazz. ClavierHouse.com. If you wish to contact us, our email address is pj@scetv.org. Our U.S. postal mail address is 1101 George Rogers Boulevard, Columbia, South Carolina, 29201. Support for Piano Jazz comes from Jazz Times Magazine. Since 1970, helping jazz fans get to know the music they love. Available on newsstands and on the web at jazztimes.com. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and NPR. Contributors include the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, celebrating 10 years of support for the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.